I'm going to focus on Vanderbilt and his impact on the political culture of the economy in the United States. How Vanderbilt played a personal role in changing the way Americans thought about what role government should have in the economy and how the economy really should be structured.
Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. I'm George Gillum, chair of the forum. Our guest today is author T.J. Stiles. T.J. is a Minnesota native who attended Carleton College, then got two master's degrees and was ABD at Columbia University. After finishing his graduate work at Columbia, he joined the Oxford University Press, where he wrote a five-volume series of historical anthologies. He became fascinated with Jesse James, who was involved as a Confederate guerrilla during the Civil War in Missouri and following the Civil War. And he published Jesse James, Last Rebel of the Civil War. This book received extraordinary reviews, and it was obvious that T.J. Stiles was going to join the rank of the great contemporary biographers. He then began work on Cornelius Vanderbilt, and after 7 years, published The First Tycoon, The Epic Life of Cornelius Vanderbilt. Mr. Stiles has blogged that Vanderbilt was at the center of American history for nearly 70 years. This was a man who drove Lafayette in a carriage, hired Daniel Webster, sat in Chief Justice John Marshall's courtroom, was in a train wreck with John Quincy Adams, gave a ferry ride to Andrew Jackson, advised Abraham Lincoln on fighting the Merrimack, and negotiated with John D. Rockefeller. The reviews of this book have also been extraordinary. The New York Times, for one, said, "This is a mighty and mighty confident work, one that moves with force and conviction and imperious wit through Vanderbilt's noisy life and times." And The Economist called it a long, and it is that, long but superbly written and researched book worthy of its subject. Please welcome T.J. Stiles.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here. I was delighted to be invited to speak at the Miller Center. And thank you all very much for coming. I appreciate it. The scope of Vanderbilt's career is something you've just heard briefly outlined. And as we were discussing how exactly I could focus my remarks for about 20 or 25 minutes, I could have gone in almost any direction in terms of American history in the 19th century, because Vanderbilt was really in the middle of it from before the War of 1812 until 1877 when he died. Somebody who lived from George Washington's presidency when he was born until the end of Reconstruction after making deals with John D. Rockefeller, as was just mentioned. So what we're gonna do is I'm going to focus on Vanderbilt and his impact on the economic, the political culture of the economy in the United States. Basically how Vanderbilt played a personal role in changing the way Americans thought about what role government should have in the economy and how the economy really should be structured. And I'd like to start off with a little bit of a puzzle from the middle of Vanderbilt's career. Now in 1859, on February 9th, Henry J. Raymond, who was the editor of the New York Times, introduced a new metaphor into the American vernacular. This was the image of the robber baron. Now, he didn't use the exact words, but he used the image, and he used it to describe Cornelius Vanderbilt. But to modern ears, his use of the concept seems a little bit strange. Now, I'll give you the quote before I give you a little explanation. Quote, "Like those old German barons who, from their eyries along the Rhine, swooped down upon the commerce of the noble river and wrung tribute from every passenger that floated by, Mr. Cornelius Vanderbilt, with all the steamers of the Accessory Transit Company in his leash, has insisted that the Pacific Mail Company should pay him toll, taken of all America that had business with California, and the Pacific Company have submitted to this demand." Now, even before I explain a little bit what the specifics were, it doesn't quite sound like our modern definition of the robber baron. Usually we think of a robber baron as a monopolist, someone with such power that he dominates markets, crushes out competitors, doesn't allow the small competitor to rise up, and corrupts government. Now, this editorial, on the other hand, was about the steamship lines that linked California to the rest of the United States during the gold rush. And the reference to the accessory transit, it was a company that Vanderbilt had started to carry passengers by way of Nicaragua to California. Pacific Mail was a line that ran to Panama, where it met up with a railroad and which connected to steamships on either side. Now, when the Nicaragua route was closed by a war, Pacific Mail paid Vanderbilt a handsome sum to not start a new line competing with it by way of Panama. The details aren't too important. The point is, the Times called Vanderbilt a robber baron because Pacific Mail paid him to stay out of the market so it could maintain its monopoly. Now, to our ears, it's Pacific Mail that was the robber baron. So the question I'm posing is, how did we get from this rather, to us, rather odd definition of a robber baron to our definition? And over the course of my talk, I'm going to talk a little bit about how this happened. It's a result of two huge transformations, or it speaks to two huge transformations that took place in the 19th century in business. Transformations that Vanderbilt took a direct part in. And these transformations were business playing a role, changes in business playing a role in transforming American society and political culture. There are moments when democracy and economics, when changes in them both coincided, each affecting the other. So let me go back to the beginning then to orient you to the first major change in which business and specifically Vanderbilt took part in. Now, Vanderbilt had started off after his birth in 1794 on a small farm in Staten Island, sailing a ferry boat, sailboat, between Staten Island and New York City. Now, at the time, New York City was not particularly impressive. It was called an overgrown seaport village by a visitor from Europe. But it was an island city that lived off the sea, and it was obvious that it was a rising place of commerce. But at the same time, it was a stronghold of what historians call the 18th century culture of deference, a hierarchical social structure in which social inferiors deferred to the gentlemen at the top. Now, New York was dominated by classic aristocracy, landed gentry who had manorial estates along the Hudson River with tenant farmers who paid them rents, just like the English aristocracy across the ocean. Social, economic, and political leadership all went together. The same set of small handful of families dominated the social scene, the business world, and state government at the beginning of the 19th century. The state constitution not only had property requirements for voting, it had two separate levels, a minimum to vote for a House of Representatives, and you had to have a higher level to vote for the governor and the state senate. And this reflects the way they saw society. Now, politics and business belonged to the same small group of notables. Personal reputation made the difference in both. Since there were few banks and little currency in circulation, business was conducted by promissory notes. A slur on your reputation might hurt your political influence or cost you additional interest on your notes. That's why the duel was so important. The whole point of a duel was not to kill the man who insulted you, but to show the world that you were willing to risk your life to defend your honor. Now, we all know that Alexander Hamilton died in a duel, which is only the most famous example of how enthusiastically Hamilton embraced the rules of the culture of deference. For example, he married into one of the most prestigious of the old aristocratic families, the Schuylers, which was the sort of move that was nearly essential for his political ambitions in New York. Now, another man who embraced the code of the duel was named Thomas Gibbons. He moved to Elizabethtown, New Jersey, just across the bay from New York, in 1801. He came from Georgia, where he was a wealthy planter. He owned an army of slaves, and he was a well-educated lawyer. He kept his plantations when he moved north, but he moved because he was trying to avoid his wife. In 1816, Gibbons, who was extremely contentious, to say the least, fell into a bitter dispute with his neighbor, Aaron Ogden, who happened to be the governor of New Jersey. So, in classic fashion, a man who'd fought three duels in his life already, Gibbons marched over to Ogden's house, horsewhip in hand, and challenged him to a duel. Ogden, who didn't like the sight of a 300-pound man charging up to his door with a horsewhip, decided to run out the back door and scramble over a fence. So Gibbons decided he would bankrupt him instead. He bought a steamboat to run to Manhattan in opposition to Ogden's steam ferry. When Gibbons' captain disappeared in late 1817, he turned to a young ferryman who had a reputation as a capable sailor and as an honest man in New York Harbor. That young man was Cornelius Vanderbilt. Now, given how imbued Gibbons himself was in the culture of deference, this business battle was particularly ironic because it was nothing less than an attack on this old hierarchical idea of society. Ogden had a license for his steamboat from the Livingston family, which had a monopoly on steamboats in New York waters. Now, the monopoly was a classic product of this culture of deference. It had been granted before steamboats had even been invented to Chancellor Robert R. Livingston as a reward for deigning to provide the people of New York with steamboats. Now, Livingston, who was one of the greatest of New York's aristocrats, did not even know how to invent a steamboat. He had to go to France and get Robert Fulton to do that. But once they succeeded, when both the Chancellor and Fulton died, the monopoly was handed down in the Livingston family to his heirs as a hereditary right. Now, the Livingstons routinely seized unlicensed steamboats that entered New York from other states, but Gibbons crafted a plan to challenge the monopoly before the Supreme Court on the grounds that states had no power to interfere with interstate commerce. Now, the young, uneducated Vanderbilt eagerly absorbed the legal details of the case. And I should note that Vanderbilt was a man who was so poorly educated, I've seen letters in his own hand in which he spelled the same three-letter word three different ways in the same letter. But that's no mark that he lacked intelligence. He went off, volunteered to go to Washington to hire Daniel Webster to represent Gibbons in this case, to argue it before the Supreme Court. And he made a point of sticking around Washington, D.C. to attend an early hearing in the Supreme Court. But in a larger sense, again, Gibbons' vendetta contributed to a growing sense in America that pieces of the economy couldn't just be carved off and handed to elite families. The belief in political equality that was enhanced by the American Revolution also extended to the economy, especially among Jefferson's Republicans. Now, Jefferson himself had some agrarian ideas that commerce was kind of not exactly the best thing. But his followers embraced laissez-faire. It was a radical idea at the time. As the historian Joyce Appleby writes, Jeffersonians eagerly clasped the invisible hand. Now, Gibbons won his case in 1824, and Ogden was thrown into debtor's prison. But Gibbons himself seems to have been a little troubled by the Pandora's box he had helped to open, this new individualistic commercial society as represented by his enterprising Captain Vanderbilt. Quote, "He will do nothing for me in winter," Gibbons complained about Vanderbilt. "He is building a new steamboat of his own. He is striking at everything. I am afraid of this man." Now, Vanderbilt ran his own businesses on the side, but he stayed loyal to Gibbons and even worked for his son for 3 years after Gibbons died in 1826. But in 1829, he went out on his own and started his own steamboat lines, radiating out of New York City. In route after route, he challenged established steamboat monopolies. Now, as he did so, he remained closely attuned to politics. This more competitive, more individualistic economy was also reflected in politics. Andrew Jackson and his followers, the Democrats, embraced laissez-faire just as the Jeffersonians had. This political matrix was again, this interaction between political ideals, people who believed in individual equality, with economic ideals, the idea that everybody should be allowed to compete. Government intervention in the economy, the Democrats believed, always tended to favor the wealthy, those who already had advantages. And in defining government intervention, they included corporate charters, which at first were granted by special acts of state legislatures and extended privileges that the Jacksonians found alarming, such as limited liability. So the corporation, to the Jacksonians, was not just another business, it was the government handing special favors to men who are already wealthy. Their view reflected a fundamental fact, one that explains politics before the Civil War. It was a fairly flat economy. You didn't have large enterprises dominating the economic landscape. It was highly plausible to believe that a poor man might build himself up and compete successfully against the wealthy as long as the playing field was level. Individualism and competition made enormous sense for radicals in a world without large enterprises. Laissez-faire was the radicalism of their era, which reflected changes in politics as well. In the 1820s, property requirements for voting fell away, such as those in New York State. Mass political parties began to emerge. Competitive politics, appealing to the common man as a voter, began to take place. A family name was no longer a requirement by the 1830s for success in politics, and Jacksonians saw no reason why it should be a requirement in business either. And no one was more humbly born or more individualistic or more competitive than Cornelius Vanderbilt. He used the name the People's Line when he competed against established lines. In his ads, he used Jacksonian language, calling his enemies this aristocratic monopoly. He said that he himself was an individual determined to resist aggression and injustice, although the odds is vastly against him. And he was scrappy. He raced his steamboats against the competition, always determined to be fastest. Now, I found court records that confirm his reputation as a brawler, finding that he fought and won more than one fistfight in these years. And the Democrats loved him. The radical New York Post called him, quote, the greatest practical anti-monopolist in the country. But the old aristocrats didn't disappear, nor did the idea of an orderly development of the economy directed from above. The Whig Party emerged in opposition to the Jacksonian radicals, and it absorbed many of the old elite who hadn't disappeared, along with many average folks who believed that government assistance and direction for economic growth in this young and developing economy was essential. So to many Whigs, competition was destructive, and not creatively destructive either. They saw it as economic anarchy that tended to annihilate much-needed capital. In 1834, for example, Philip Hone, who was an aristocratic former mayor of New York, took Vanderbilt's discount boat from Albany to New York. It led him to complain in his diary, quote, if the people do not rise in their might and put a stop to the racing and opposition, it will be better to return to the primitive mode of traveling to Albany in sloops. If the people do not rise, against what? Cheap and fast travel? Hone saw firsthand how popular this new age of competition and of price cutting was, but he didn't believe his own eyes. Now, not all Whigs despise competition as much as Hone did, but it speaks to a certain strain of thinking in American politics that exalted orderly state-assisted development, preferably led by socially prestigious men. And at this point, I'd just like to note, it drives me crazy when I see people describe one party or another in early America as pro-business. The fact is, they were all pro-business. They were all pro-market economy, but they had very different ideas about how the market economy should develop. One was very exalted competition. The other said, we need some central direction, some central assistance to help develop our country. And that brings us to Pacific Mail. During the Mexican War, before the discovery of gold in California, the federal government wanted to provide mail service to the relative handful of citizens on the Pacific coast. Now, this was thought to be a strategic priority. The US government was afraid that without a regular connection we might actually lose control of California. It might become independent or be absorbed by another country. And so the Democrats, who actually ran the country at the time, used a classic Whig scheme. It established a huge subsidy for steamship lines to run to the West Coast, connecting via a land crossing at Panama. And again, this shows that once people were actually in power, the party ideology was one thing, the practical demands of public policy was another. So I'm sketching out the way people argued about politics, but when it comes to public policy, sometimes the Democrats were Whigs themselves. So they established this huge subsidy for steamship lines, and two companies picked up the subsidy, the US Mail Steamship Company on the Atlantic and the Pacific Mail on the Pacific. And Pacific Mail, in particular, was the perfect Whig enterprise. Well run, well capitalized, it met a public need, and it was organized by a leader of New York's mercantile aristocracy, William H. Aspinwall. Now, these steamship lines started to operate exactly when the gold rush began. They immediately became outrageously profitable, but they kept collecting this huge federal subsidy year after year for the full 10 years of the original contract. Now, despite the subsidy, and despite the domination of these steamship lines to California, which until the Transcontinental Railroad in 1869 were the main way that the eastern states communicated with California, despite the monopoly and the subsidy, Vanderbilt decided to compete. He planned a canal across Nicaragua, farther north than Panama. Now, his funding for the canal fell through, but he began to carry passengers across Nicaragua, setting up the accessory transit company to do the work, connecting with his steamships on either ocean. Now, I'm not going to go into the details. There's an entire part of my book about the epic conflict between the steamship lines that actually resulted in a war in which Vanderbilt intervened, sending down a secret agent and a crate full of gold down to Costa Rica. But in 1856, in essence, that war closed down the Nicaragua route. Pacific Mail and US Mail began to pay Vanderbilt the subsidy to stay away. So this is the background that explains the attack on Vanderbilt as a robber baron. Raymond, the editor of the New York Times, was an old Whig, and even though the Whig Party had already ceased to exist, he still had the same basic mindset about the economy. Pacific Mail, this kind of classic Whig ideal company, was the sort of company that he thought was the perfect company. Vanderbilt was the spoiler who came in and made things hard for this established line subsidized by the government. So to Raymond of the New York Times, Vanderbilt was a robber baron because he was too competitive. He was a spoiler pursuing, quote, competition for competition's sake, competition which crowds out legitimate enterprises. Raymond wrote in another editorial about Vanderbilt that it was time, quote, for our mercantile community to look the curse of competition fully in the face. Now, in 1855, Vanderbilt defended himself against such attacks with a classic statement of Jacksonian philosophy. Quote, it is said that I am always in opposition, he wrote, which they used as a term for competition, that the same spirit of opposition which has hitherto governed my action has influenced me now. I have only to say that this is the same spirit which founded this great republic and which is now drawing the commerce of the world to our shores. The share of prosperity which has fallen to my lot is the direct result of unfettered trade and unrestrained competition, end quote. Now, what neither Raymond nor Vanderbilt realized was that the second huge change I was talking about was just starting. This was a change in scale. So whereas Vanderbilt early in life had helped create a new, more competitive economy, more individualistic, less dominated by old families, now he was beginning to create a change in which the economy was increasingly dominated by very large enterprises. So in Vanderbilt's case, for example, until the gold rush, he had run local steamboat lines out of New York. Now he had a transcontinental enterprise with bases in foreign countries, with bases in the far side of the continent spanning thousands of miles, affecting hundreds of thousands of people. So the relatively flat nature of the American economy was beginning to disappear about the time that he was being criticized for being too competitive. And the political debate was going to change along with these economic changes. Now, this was especially true in railroads. Now, in keeping with the early nature of American corporations, the first railroads were essentially seen as public works. Even though they were privately owned, they were designed to serve specific, limited public needs. Now, at the time of the Civil War, the nation had about 30,000 miles of track, which is pretty impressive, but the network was broken up into little lines designed to serve local communities. It was fragmented into hundreds of little lines. Now, the original charter of the Erie Railway, for example, actually prohibited it from connecting to lines that ran out of New York State. Now, in 1863, Vanderbilt took control of the New York and Harlem Railroad, which is a pretty typical example of these limited lines. Now, by this time, he was an old man, especially by the standards of the time. Pardon me for anyone who's this age. I mean by the standards of the time. He was 69 years old. Now, in 1863, that was well past life expectancy. He bought control of the Harlem because he wanted to show, as a matter of pride, that he could take a company that everyone thought was worthless and make it profitable. But what happened is that problems inherent in the fragmented nature of the railroad system led him into one conflict after another with the connecting lines. Disputes with the Hudson River Railroad, for example, which ran parallel to the Harlem, led him to buy control of it in 1864. Then he was dependent upon the New York Central Railroad, which ran between Albany and Buffalo, New York, for his traffic from the West. He tried diplomacy with the managers of the New York Central year in and year out. Eventually, a group of businessmen who hated Vanderbilt took control of the New York Central in December 1866. They revoked a hard-won agreement with Vanderbilt's railroads, and Vanderbilt responded in classic form. He stopped all train traffic coming into New York City from the West. Now, this was in deep winter. The Hudson River was frozen. Winter storms had shut down ferry traffic into Manhattan. With one blow, Cornelius Vanderbilt effectively blockaded the nation's largest city, halting all connection with the rest of the country. Now, the blockade had two effects. First, it collapsed the stock price of New York Central, allowing Vanderbilt to buy control of it, something he never planned at the beginning. Second, it ignited a national debate over the power that a corporation could have over the economic life of the country. Now, neither the state nor the national government had the regulatory power to stop Vanderbilt from doing what he did. And so, as a result, Vanderbilt grew increasingly powerful. He amalgamated the Hudson River and New York Central Railroads into one of the first giant corporations in American history, which towered over the economy of New York, the nation's richest and largest state. He purchased control of the Lakeshore Railway, which gave him a line to Chicago. As the Railroad Gazette wrote of him in his obituary, quote, "His early career as a railroad manager was distinguished by a series of bold, startling, revolutionary measures which attracted universal attention and had the effect of reaching far beyond the lines and companies with which he dealt directly. The Vanderbilt era was the first great era of consolidations. That it was created by Vanderbilt would be too much to say, but that he was the first great actor in it, but he was the first great actor and apparently hastened its coming." So with Vanderbilt, the nation got big business. Now, I'm not trying to condemn Vanderbilt for this. He was always honest as a businessman, as tough as he was, and he created vast new wealth for the country as well as for himself. His consolidated railroad line greatly increased economic efficiency, lowered costs, and integrated markets across the country. My point is that the rise of big business destroyed the antebellum political debate by destroying the level economic landscape that had shaped it. Vanderbilt himself never changed his laissez-faire philosophy. As he pioneered a new disparity in wealth, as he created huge enterprises that towered over the economic landscape, his views went from radical to conservative without ever changing. Laissez-faire went from a demand that the government not help the wealthy so the individual could compete and rise by his merits to a demand that the government not regulate or limit the power that these new large corporations had. Now, the idea that the government should regulate the economy to counterbalance such a disparity also stemmed not only from big business, but from the Civil War. Now, as Neil Ferguson and plenty of other historians have pointed out, war is a great centralizer of power, and a creator of strong governments. During the Civil War, a struggle for national survival, the federal government took on powers that were unthinkable only a few months before. It not only mobilized a vast military machine, it, for the first time, created an apparatus by which the federal government reached down and touched the lives of individuals as never before. There was an income tax and a federal bureau of revenue. There was a national currency, the greenback, which had not existed before the Civil War. It created a national bank system, federally chartering national banks across the country. After the war, the federal government took on the administration of southern states and began also to protect individual civil rights for the first time. The idea of government intervention to protect the more disadvantaged, as opposed to helping the wealthy, began to take off. So with the rise of big business focused on the person of Vanderbilt, we see the modern political argument beginning to take shape. In 1866, even before Vanderbilt consolidated his lines, Harper's wrote, quote, "Some method must be devised of emancipating the country from the tyranny of these vast corporations." The New York Times wrote, "We are beginning to feel the first grindings of the approaching tyranny of capitalists or corporations. Every public means of transit is in the hands of these tyrants of modern society, the capitalists." But as I said, this was only the beginnings of the new debate. The Times went on to say, quote, "It is no part of our present purpose to suggest a remedy. Frankly, we confess that we see none." So not everybody agreed. One newspaper, The Round Table, published an editorial attacking Vanderbilt for his blockade of New York City. It wrote, quote, "Congress, under its power to regulate interstate commerce, is the only source whence effectual remedy can come." In 1868, a House committee looked into the question of federal regulation of railroads. It reported, "The great railroad corporations do possess the power and will to absorb the lesser competing lines. These vast consolidated companies have the power to crush out all competition." But the committee, even though it said Congress did have the authority, frankly couldn't bring itself to actually suggest any action by Congress. The political culture of the country was in a moment of transition. People were beginning to think about federal regulation, but they couldn't quite commit themselves to it yet. But American radicalism was already embracing government regulation. The rise of big business was mirrored by the rise of a labor movement. In May 1872, for example, 100,000 workers in New York went on strike to demand a law limiting the workday to 8 hours. The Grange began to rise in the West to battle the railroads. Quote, "We hold that a state cannot create a corporation that it cannot thereafter control," declared a Missouri chapter of the Grange. One radical speaker said to a crowd, "The time would come when the management of the railroads must fall into the hands of the public." Now, Vanderbilt had inadvertently transformed American radicalism and politics in general by transforming the economy, by pioneering the rise of the giant corporation. And again, I'm not telling you this is bad or good. I'm looking at the argument at the time and how Vanderbilt played this role, how Americans began to change the way they argued about politics and the economy. But his personal outlook remained unchanged. Now, for example, after his blockade, New York's legislature considered a bill to give the state engineer the power to settle any dispute between railroad lines. And Vanderbilt responded with a curious statement, quote, "If you could pass a law compelling men to take better care of their interests than their interests will compel them without the law, then it is well enough." In essence, he didn't recognize that there was a public interest separate from private interests. He never read the Adam Smith's book, The Wealth of Nations, I'm sure, and yet he was a classic Smith-type thinker. He believed that society advanced by everybody aggressively pursuing their own private interests as strongly as possible. As he also told the state legislature, quote, "I have always served the public to the best of my ability. Why? Because it is to my interest to do so." Now, in his youth, he had helped to forge a competitive, individualistic marketplace, one that both reflected and also influenced political ideology. Now, as an old man, he'd helped to create an age of big business, the Vanderbilt era, as the Railroad Gazette called it. What he himself did not realize or even care about was that the new economy, with its huge disparities in wealth and power, was destroying the old political debate. And the explosion of federal power in the Civil War created a ferment, leading some people to think in new ways about government regulation. But it took decades for the repercussions of these changes to work themselves out, long after his death. The New Deal, for example, would have been unthinkable in 1872 when a panic and depression began, because the orthodoxies of an earlier era still strongly shaped the way lawmakers thought. And political ideology is a complicated thing. It's not just business drives politics. There are a lot of values that people have that they carry into these arguments. But with the age of Vanderbilt, we see where the modern corporate economy began, and along with it, where the modern political debate began to take shape. So that ends my remarks. Thank you very much. So I focus my remarks on this particular question, Vanderbilt and his impact on political culture. But as we take questions, I invite questions on any subject, whether it's, you know, his family or his businesses or any topic that you would like to bring up.
TJ, I'd like to start by asking you to address your earlier work on Jesse James. It seems to me, from what little I know, that Jesse James was an ideologue who used his particular money-making activities to promote his political ideology, whereas Vanderbilt was much less of an ideologue and used whatever his political inclinations were to support his money-making activities.
That's an interesting way to put it.
Could you give us maybe the Reader's Digest version of Jesse James and then talk about how you moved from that into Vanderbilt?
Sure. This is a thank you very much for the question. When I started to work on my book about Jesse James, I had, you know, the idea that he'd been underestimated in his role, the importance of his identity as a former Confederate guerrilla in the divided state of Missouri. And that I knew at the outset that a lot of his letters to the press talked about, some of them attacked President Grant and attacked the radical Republicans. And these are aspects of his own letters to the press that had been downplayed or ignored by historians in the past. And as I looked into it, I found that it was actually more the case than I had thought at the beginning. So for example, I believe that Jesse James was a criminal first and foremost. He was in it for the money. He robbed banks and trains because that's where the money was. But what distinguishes him from all other bandits virtually in the entire 19th century, but even former Confederate guerrillas who became bandits, is that his insistence on bringing politics into it, his using his fame and his close friendship with a former Confederate newspaper editor in Missouri to promote himself as a symbol of Confederate defiance after the Union victory and of resistance to Reconstruction, and also to try to mobilize Confederates to take over the Democratic Party in Missouri. It's not that he wasn't, you know, a criminal out for the money, a violent man by nature. It's what distinguishes him is this unusual political element that he kept bringing in. And he was successful and stayed free far longer than the typical outlaw of the 19th century. And I think it's because of the way in which he got support from former Confederates who gave him shelter, who gave him information, and it really explains him much better than anything else that has come before. Now, I was surprised that there was less of an element of anti-railroad sentiment than I thought. I thought there'd be some, and I found almost none. And one of the things that I looked at was his robbing trains. I tried to understand the financial and railroad system. And this is the beginnings of my transition into Vanderbilt. And I found, for example, that under the financial system at the time, in which most banks had been converted to national banks, they were required to maintain reserves with banks in reserve cities, and banks there had to maintain reserves with banks in New York. And then in the fall, So money would flow, physical cash would flow to New York by train during the year. Then in the fall, when the crops were harvested, it was called the moving of the crops. So all the transactions involved in harvesting, the purchase of crops and livestock, the shipment to the seaports, caused a drain on those reserves because they needed the cash for all the transactions during the fall. And so cash is moving in a seasonal flow across the country. When the cotton harvest happened, there was a seasonal flow north and south as well. And Jesse James was very smart about robbing trains moving in the right direction. Now, he wasn't always lucky. Sometimes it wasn't very much. But they rarely, in their train robberies, they were very smart about it. But they rarely robbed passengers. They only robbed passengers when the express safe in the baggage car was empty. And the express companies were different from railroad companies. So when I was looking through the correspondence of the governors of Missouri, they would contact a railroad company after a robbery and say, can you help us catch the bandits? And then a few months later, the railroad president would write back saying, oh, yeah, good luck with that. We're not really interested in this, because they lost nothing in robberies. The express companies, you know, UPS, if it didn't have its own planes, or FedEx, imagine them, you know, sending their couriers on United Airlines or US Airways. If a plane was robbed and they took the express messenger off and everything he was carrying, it's UPS or FedEx that's losing the money. So the express companies are outraged. They're the ones who hired the Pinkertons. And the average farmer didn't care about express companies. They didn't have anything to do with the movement of crops, or they were not particularly large. They were wealthy, but they weren't particularly large or oppressive. So there was no connection made by anyone between, at the time, they understood the way this worked. They didn't see Jesse James as hurting the railroads. And so that helped undercut further the idea that he was some sort of anti-capitalist Robin Hood. He was really popular because of his Confederate identity. But this looking into the railroad system, the way the financial system worked, really made me interested in the whole economic side of the making of the modern United States. And that's what interests me about the 19th century United States. This is when we see modernity coming into being, around the time of the Civil War. And what I found myself doing with each of my biographies is I'm looking at the same period, but I'm kind of broadening the canvas each time. And I like to focus on subjects who have dramatic lives, that are fun to write about, fun to read about. I tend to gravitate toward people who are physically adventurous. John D. Rockefeller was, you know, a pious bookkeeper whose business transactions are enormously important, but he's personally not the kind of guy who I'm interested in writing about. Vanderbilt was out getting in fistfights, racing his trotters against all comers, personally pioneering the path through the jungle in Nicaragua. You know, this is the kind of guy who I think is a lot of fun and incredibly important. And his life is, you know, he lived through, I think, 18 presidencies, and he knew most of them himself. He's somebody who's incredibly important, shows up everywhere in the 19th century, and yet there hadn't been a biography of him since 1942, and that was pretty limited to his business career. There's a lot of information that's come to light since then. So he really was a ripe subject and a really attractive subject, you know, to tell a good story and to talk about big questions. And that's what I try to do. And so that transition seemed pretty natural for me.
Thank you, Mr. Stiles. It was a wonderful talk, and it's a fascinating subject. It seems to me that the characters in those days were so much more colorful and much larger than life. And today, our movers and shakers seem just dull as dishwater by comparison. Do you think that's an illusion of history? Or is there more something to it? And is there anybody that you see in our landscape today that is anything like Cornelius Vanderbilt, who also, it seems, must have had an IQ of 180 or something? I mean, it's extraordinary the way he, with no education, came so far. Can you comment on that?
I do not set myself up as an expert on the present, certainly. And people are welcome to draw any conclusions they like from my book. I really tried to look at, you know, the 19th century in its own terms. So, for example, people have looked at Vanderbilt as either an evil robber baron or an example of the unfettered market and how great it is. I had no interest in teaching anybody any lessons about the present. I really wanted, except for, you know, where did we come from? You know, where did the origins? So I'm careful about certainly in my book and personally, I'm not an expert on the modern times. But I think that my feeling is that, you know, we see about the time of Vanderbilt's life, American life became more institutional. And this is something I talk about. You know, you had large organizations. Government got larger. Businesses got larger. Instead of, there's still plenty of people working for themselves, but the large organization began to expand and take up more and more space in American life. And so, you know, Abraham Lincoln's a good example. You know, he, as a young man, you know, he worked as a rail splitter, he worked on flatboats, he worked for other people. And then he went off and became a lawyer and worked for himself. And that was the path that people expected. Sure, as a young man, you might work for somebody else, but eventually you're going to have your own shop or farm. And with the rise, especially of the Railroad Corporation, but other corporations start to emerge after the Civil War on a large scale, and business started to get government started to get larger, the idea of being a professional or of being a lifetime worker in a large organization, working for someone else for your entire life, that started to become a more and more common pattern. And I think life has become more institutional, and it's become a little less individualistic. That change in American life starts to take place in Vanderbilt's time, and he certainly led the way by forming this huge corporation. So, you know, if you look at even at corporations, Vanderbilt, while he's helping to forge the way for the future, at the same time represents an older world. His corporations, he was always the majority stockholder in them. They were his property. Whereas, even at the time, you start to see the modern CEO, who is basically hired by the shareholders. Well, technically, they often hire themselves. But, you know, that starts to take place in Vanderbilt's time. So younger men such as Thomas A. Scott, who was Andrew Carnegie's mentor, he was the head of the Pennsylvania Railroad. He came up through the ranks. He was a railroad professional. He was hired by the stockholders, the board of directors. He was not, he was not the owner. He was working for the owners of that company. And he was very good at it, but he also pioneered skimming money out of the corporation, because he got money by doing things like setting up dummy corporations and contracting with those dummy corporations to do the railroad's business, and he personally would own that corporation. So he was both a very good executive, which is why he lasted so long, but he also got rich by learning how to skim money out of the Pennsylvania Railroad. And this is what Andrew Carnegie learned, and so when he started his steel company, he made sure it was a private company. He wasn't going to be hiring, you know, an anonymous shareholder and some guy he doesn't know is running it. He was right there, personally owning it with a couple of partners, making sure that no one was going to be doing what his own mentor had been doing to the Pennsylvania. And so, not that, you know, professional executives are inherently bad. That's not what I'm trying to say. I'm trying to say that, you know, this whole new world of the hired manager and the sort of anonymous passive stockholder, which is the way most corporations run today, starts to emerge in Vanderbilt's time. He himself represented, he's very colorful, and he's a guy who literally fought his way to the top personally. He didn't just rise through the ranks. He didn't go to business school. He was somebody who was out there battling, you know, with his rivals. And so, you know, you have, you know, figures like, Jay Gould, was not as dramatic, but certainly, you know, had a real flair for the sleight of hand and dramatic move on Wall Street. Jim Fisk was incredibly colorful, Jay Gould's partner. You know, these guys are, this is a real buccaneering days in the making of modern Wall Street, when you saw this the sort of stuff that doesn't happen today, and in part also because we have a more regulated economy today. Daniel Drew, when he was reported on by a credit bureau, the ancestor of Dun & Bradstreet, R.G. Dun & Company, they commented that he was Daniel Drew's treasurer of the Erie Railroad and engaged in inside trading. So their conclusion was, therefore, he's good for his debts because he's unlikely to go bankrupt. And, you know, the larger public, you know, most people didn't own stock. They thought that was crooked, which most stockholders would think is crooked also. But in terms of the business world, a lot of people were doing this. This was seen as what you do. You get in a position of authority, you know, you take advantage of it. And so the business morals were kind of in flux. It was a real Wild West on Wall Street. And Vanderbilt was distinguished by his contemporaries, for he was colorful, but he was always honest. And he said, my philosophy is you run a corporation as if it's your private property. And he never took a salary. The only remuneration he got was in dividends on his stock. So if he was going to make money out of his railroad, he had to make it profitable year in and year out. And he engaged in things like, you know, short selling and a lot of nasty moves, but always to punish his enemies, never to manipulate his own companies to profit off, you know, manipulating the stock, which is what Daniel Drew did all the time. Yes, sir.
Yeah, well, first of all, I want to correct the record. We haven't run out of strong, colorful characters. They're still out there. And just for one that comes to mind, Fred Smith, who built single-handedly built Federal Express, a very strong personality and an amazing man, the way he put that huge company together with tremendous productivity.
Very good point.
But anyway, having spent 40 years in Washington involved in railroad regulation, I was fascinated by your talk, and I'm going to get your book. I'm glad it's out there. I think one thing to mention about railroad regulation is that with all the trouble that you described in the 19th century, Congress finally passed the Interstate Commerce Act in 1886, and that was passed at the request of the railroads in order to suppress competition. Everybody thinks it came along to protect the public. For the first 15 years, they didn't decide a single case. Anyway, I do have a question. My question, very simply, is we have people out there today like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett who are immensely wealthy. How could you compare the wealth that Vanderbilt was able to put together with people like Buffett and Gates, or is that impossible?
Well, two things. First, I just want to say I totally agree with you that, and this is something I point out, that Vanderbilt's own personality became more gentlemanly over the years. The fist fighter of his youth began to disappear. And one reason is he went into railroads. He had to, because unlike steamboats, you know, a steamboat owner loses or is bought out, he can take his steamboat somewhere else, or it's pretty cheap to build a new one. Railroads don't move. And so even when a line went into bankruptcy, and there's a lot of railroad economics I won't go into right now, but basically, you know, you cut prices, and even if a line goes bankrupt, it's still going to be right next to you running, competing for business. So there's always a tendency in the railroad industry, due to the nature of the industry, to try to come to terms and set prices and create cartels. And it was just the logic of the industry. It's the way railroads ran. So they actually, you're right, they supported the Interstate Commerce Commission when it was created. Vanderbilt helped to actually forge some major cartels. Eventually broke down, but you know.
100 years later, they terminated the Interstate Commerce Commission, and they created the National Transportation Board, which really has the same function. So things are pretty much the same. There's still a regulation out there, and of course the railroads are very active before the board.
Yeah, and this is something that goes to the point, you know, it's we all have our ideals about what's good. For example, I think competition, most people think competition's a good thing. But, you know, you look at the realities of industries like railroads, and it gets problematic. Once you get into the weeds, all of a sudden you see what the problems are. And so, you know, so rather than like attacking, condemning, and or praising in my book, I would rapidly get nowhere. And so I discussed the pressures and the way people reacted to them, et cetera, but without trying to say this is good, this is bad, because frankly, I couldn't solve the problems of railroad regulation. You know, I have no idea. I just talk about how they try to deal with these issues. In terms of his wealth, one thing I do not do in my book is give modern equivalent figures. And the reason is that the economy was so different that you can't just say, oh, multiply by, you know, 105 and you'll get the modern amount. For example, the railroad industry was so huge. Vanderbilt's New York Central Railroad, when it was, they finished consolidation, the par value of the stock, which I won't go explain now, was about $100 million, which is the total amount of investment in all manufacturing in the United States at the time of the start of the Civil War. So it gives you an idea of you know, okay, there's a little span of years between those two points, but it gives you an idea of how railroads were just vastly larger than any other industry. Individual companies were larger than entire industries of other industries. So you can't just say, okay, that economy is just like a balloon, and it's larger, and this is the way it is now. So one thing I do to compare is I look at the measure of the amount of currency in circulation then and now. And if you use the Fed's M2 figure for the amount of money in circulation just before the fall, the crash last fall. Bill Gates, who Forbes called the richest man in the country, in the world, if he could have sold all of his assets at full market value to American buyers just before the crash last year, he would have taken one out of every $138 in the US economy using the Fed's M2 figure. If Vanderbilt could have done the same using the controller of the currency's measure of money, including cash and demand deposits, in 1877, when he died, he would have taken one out of every $20. So he not only controlled all the railroads that ran into New York City, he not only was the biggest man in the biggest industry, he had this enormous wealth. So, you know, when he died and he wanted to leave 95% of it to one son to keep the empire together, needless to say, his nine other children were a little upset, even though they were all made quite wealthy by the will. But 5% divided among the rest of them didn't seem fair to them. And so it was such a huge amount of money in dispute that there was a trial, and it went on for 2.5 years, and there was all kinds of stuff that was said. Some of it's interesting, some of it's total garbage. And so I talk about that in the course of my book as well. Yes?
Hi, I was wondering about the quotes in your talk. For example, the ones from the New York Times or Harper seem to be mostly opposed to his view. Was that reflecting the editor's opinions, for example, Raymond, or was it reflecting the trends in the press or the public, and did it ever change during Vanderbilt's lifetime? Thank you.
That's an interesting question, because the press was very different during Vanderbilt's lifetime than it is today. You know, recently we've had more media that, you know, takes an explicit political viewpoint. But in the 19th century, not only were newspapers explicitly partisan, but newspaper editors actually helped shape party philosophy. Newspaper editors were basically framing the way parties saw and argued over issues. So they would do legitimate news reporting, but sometimes even the news reporting would have a twist. And certainly the editorials are explicitly partisan. And so that's why there's still a lot of newspapers today that were founded in the 19th century that are, you know, the St. Louis Democrat, you know, the St. Louis Republican, that they would have these explicit labels even in their names. So there actually were people who defended Vanderbilt. I mentioned one, the New York Post, which was a radical Jacksonian paper in the 1830s. And it defended Vanderbilt then. Harper's actually was a more democratic newspaper magazine in the 1850s, and it defended Vanderbilt from these charges from the New York Times, calling him a robber baron, saying, you know, he's done the country tremendous good, but it praised him as an individual. You know, the idea that Democrats liked competition in business, but they didn't like corporations. And so even though Vanderbilt was beginning to operate more and more through corporations, they praised him because he was an individual fighting corporations. So, you know, sometimes these arguments don't make sense to us, but they were very much a part of party politics. And so at the end of his life and in his later years, when he was so powerful as a railroad king, you know, there were still people who strongly defended him. And even people who attacked him still said, well, you know, he is honest. And he always, you know, he's not somebody who's ripping off his stockholders. We'll give him that. So even the people who didn't like what he represented respected him personally.
Thank you very much. I'm curious to know what is known about Vanderbilt's opinions regarding secession, the need to preserve the Union, and also in general regarding slavery. Is there much of a record?
That's a very interesting question, because Vanderbilt was not a sentimental man. His family, you know, sometimes he was very good to his family, and other times, let's put it this way, he treated his family like it was a business, and he put a lot of pressure on his underlings in business. But when it came to patriotism, he was very sentimental. He was deeply patriotic. And I like to say he named his three sons after his three heroes. George Washington was his youngest son. His oldest son was William Henry, after William Henry Harrison, the American general. And his middle son was named Cornelius Vanderbilt. So those are his three heroes. But he was very patriotic. And when the Civil War broke out, he tried to give his largest steamship, which is one of the two or three largest steamships in the world, as a gift to the Union Navy. And he said, if you don't want it as a gift, then name a board to set a fair price and buy it at whatever price, you know, a board of commodores, which is the highest rank in the Navy before the Civil War, where he got his nickname from. You know, whatever they want is fine. And Gideon Welles, the Union Navy Secretary, didn't want the gift because he thought the war would be over soon and the steamship would be expensive to operate. And he didn't like, you know, these Wall Street men coming in and thinking they knew better than him, and he said no. And so Vanderbilt basically was forced to lease his ships to the War Department by ship brokers who he called outside thieves, who came in and had the power to requisition private ships at prices that they set, and they took a commission. So what happened when the Virginia, the first Confederate ironclad, steamed out of Norfolk Harbor and wreaked havoc, we all know that the Monitor came to the scene the next day and battled it to a standstill. But the Virginia was, you know, they made repairs, they were fine the next day. And if the Monitor had simply had a mechanical breakdown, the Union Navy and the administration knew that they would be helpless against the Virginia, or the Merrimack, as it was originally called. So Secretary of War Stanton contacted Vanderbilt. He rushed to Washington, met with Lincoln personally, and they said, can you help? And how much will you charge? Lincoln said. And he said, nothing. I will outfit my ship as with a ram, huge ship, much faster than the Virginia. He said it can outmaneuver it and run it down and sink it. And my guess is they won't even bother come out to fight against it. It'll bottle up the Virginia. And he goes, it'll be yours for free. And he did it. On his own expense, he converted it to a warship, gave it to the Union Navy, brought it down to Hampton Roads. The Confederates wrote in their own reports, you know, the very powerful warship Vanderbilt, he named it after himself, is here, and they never came out to fight. Once they steamed out, while Lincoln himself was watching, and it saw that the Vanderbilt and the Monitor were both there, and it turned around and went back. And then when they captured Norfolk Harbor, they scuttled the Virginia. And then what he did is, on his own expense, he converted the Vanderbilt into a cruiser to hunt after the Confederate commerce raider, the Alabama. And it's interesting because Raphael Semmes, the captain of the Alabama, knew that the Vanderbilt was out hunting for him, a gift from Vanderbilt. So he deliberately targeted Vanderbilt's California steamship line carrying gold from California, well, of course, because it had gold, and also to get back at Vanderbilt personally. And he captured one of Vanderbilt's ships and talked about this, said, you know, he was determined to hurt Vanderbilt personally. Unfortunately for him, he captured a ship going the wrong way. And while a ship full of gold went past him. But as a result of this, Vanderbilt was able to, he presented a plan for convoying the ships, and the Alabama never took the chance again. So, you know, he played a very personal role in the Union war effort, and a very honorable one, I think, that's been caricatured as greedy, when in fact it wasn't. After the war, interestingly, the flip side occurred. His patriotism extended to wanting to help unite the North and South, and it became a personal project. He was one of the bondsmen for the release of Jefferson Davis from federal prison. He married his second wife, who was also his second cousin, was from Mobile, Alabama, and he was very proud of the fact that she was not only from the South, but an unrepentant Confederate. And she has great letters from being in Saratoga Springs, meeting with Union generals and old, you know, strong Unionists, and arguing with them about the Civil War. He had Braxton Bragg and his brother, who was, you know, Braxton Bragg was a Confederate general. His brother was Attorney General of the Confederate government. They were witnesses at his wedding, his second wedding. And he deliberately endowed, I could go on and on, he deliberately endowed Vanderbilt because it was in the South. And he wanted to make a matching gift, basically a $1 million gift. He helped the Union Navy. He wanted to help the South by giving $1 million to found a university in the South. So, and this interest in helping the South is the theme that runs throughout his acts of charity in late life. And it was very sincere. And again, it reflected his ideas of wanting to unite North and South. Now, when it comes to race, he himself, you know, was never involved in slaveholding, but I don't think he had any particular compunctions against it. He really very much took society as it was, and that's fine. He had, for example, when he was a young man, there were actually a lot of black sailors, even who sometimes captained ferries themselves, and he dealt with them, and it was just, that was life. And then later, you know, he had black men working for him. And then later, he, you know, he had a wife who was from the South, and had, I'm sure, had strong attitudes about slavery and race, and that was fine. You know, he, it just wasn't a big deal for him one way or the other, I think.
We'll let that be the last word. As a convenience to our patrons, we'll be offering copies of The First Tycoon, Cornelius Vanderbilt, for sale out front. One of our guests came up to me before the forum and said, you know, I bought the book during the summer and I read it, but I can't find it to get it signed. Now, let me say that there is nothing wrong, and in fact, it's a sign of real intellectual strength and moral purity to own two copies of the book. Please join me in thanking T.J. Stiles.
Thank you very much.